Seabury Resources for Aging is a proud partner of Aging Matters. As a nonprofit, Seabury serves older adults in the Washington, D.C. region and across the United States with its care management model to support caregivers and their loved ones. Seabury is a pioneer in the field of services for older adults, providing affordable housing and support services to help older adults age in place. For more information, visit their website, seaburyresources.org, or call them at 202-289-5690. Hello and welcome to Aging Matters, a program featuring aging-related topics of interest to older adults and their families. I'm Cheryl Beversdorf, your host. Long-term care ombudsman programs work to settle problems related to the health, safety, welfare, and rights of individuals who live in long-term care facilities. A long-term care ombudsman serves as an advocate for residents by investigating and resolving complaints about long-term care facilities and their services, and helping families find a facility that provides quality care. Today, my guests are Camden Doran, supervisor of the Northern Virginia Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, and Amity Overall Labe, director of the National Ombudsman Resource Center. They're going to provide details about the Ombudsman Program and how it addresses complaints of residents in long-term care facilities. And they'll also talk about what families should know and look for when selecting the best long-term care facility for a loved one. Welcome, Camden and Amity, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Amity, let's start with you. Help us understand more. What is the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program? What's its purpose? And tell us what an ombudsman is. What was the legal authorization and what ombudsman programs are required to do?
I'm so thankful for this time today because it's a very unique and special and important program. For some background, in the early 70s, there were widespread reports of abuse and really poor conditions in nursing facilities. So the program was created at first as an initiative to address those conditions and by responding to complaints and going in and visiting with residents directly. After seeing the impact of the program, there were some amendments to the federal law, which is called the Older Americans Act in 1978. And those amendments required every state to have an ombudsman program. The purpose of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program is to advocate with and for individuals living in nursing facilities as well as residential care communities. We'll talk a bit more about residential care communities, but in general, that means assisted living or boarding care homes. They're called different things in every state. Each state has a state ombudsman. And that state ombudsman oversees the statewide program. They train and designate representatives, both paid and volunteer representatives, to carry out the program duties and go into the facilities and visit with residents. The program really is unique because it's the only program focused solely on the resident. They follow resident direction. They investigate and resolve complaints with the goal of resident satisfaction. They are not regulatory, so they don't go into facilities to cite them for deficiencies or make sure that the facilities are following regulations. They don't enforce penalties. They are not adult protective services workers that are investigating from that perspective. They are going in to empower residents, make sure they understand their rights, and amplify resident voices.
Amity, when we talk about ombudsman, is that a person or is that a team of people? Help us understand a little bit more about the actual word ombudsman.
The word ombudsman originally is a Swedish word, and the traditional sense of an ombudsman was to work between the citizens and the government. So they weren't necessarily an advocate ombudsman, they were a mediator between a citizen and a government. But this use of the ombudsman is an advocate ombudsman. Without getting too nitty-gritty into the details of program administration, There is a state ombudsman, and that is one person whose sole purpose is to manage the statewide ombudsman program. And then they designate ombudsman program representatives. And so those representatives are paid staff across the state or volunteers or a mix of both. And they go out and conduct investigations, visit with residents, look at facility conditions, and do other activities such as sharing information about resident rights, sharing information about how to start a family council and supporting resident councils. They do a lot more than just investigating complaints. In fact, ombudsman programs across the country are required by federal law and federal regulation to share information with residents, to share best care practices. For example, if the ombudsman program learns about a new way to support residents, to provide good care, to make sure that hydration is happening, especially during the pandemic, oftentimes ombudsman program heard about new requirements related to personal protective equipment or other things that facilities were supposed to do or things that were working well, then they would share those good care practices. They're also required to share information about facilities and long-term services and supports with the public. So if a person is looking for a facility, or maybe their loved one isn't ready for a facility yet, but they maybe need other supports and services, then an ombudsman could answer questions, share information. They make sure residents have regular and timely access to ombudsman services by doing those visits. They support the development of resident and family councils. They advocate for change, not just individual complaints, but some systems advocacy. And that system could be just that one nursing facility itself, or it could be a chain of facilities, or it could even be legislation. And so that's another reason the program is so unique. Not only is it resident-focused and resident-directed, this program is required to do systems advocacy. So speak with the media, educate legislators about what's going on in these facilities and what residents need. Educate the public about some legislation that's pending or some laws that changed. So it's really quite a comprehensive program.
What knowledge and expertise do ombudsmen have? Do they get some kind of training, or how does that work?
Nationwide, to ensure consistency across the country and program services, there are some federal minimum training standards that all programs have to meet. So those training standards include a minimum of 36 hours of initial certification training, and that is for paid staff representatives as well as volunteers, and 18 hours of annual continuing education. The minimum training standards also include a range of topics that the training must cover. And actually, our resource center, we created a curriculum that covers that basic information that states can utilize.
I work for the Northern Virginia Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, and we're located in Fairfax County. We're a regional program. We also serve residents in Arlington County, City of Alexandria, and Loudoun County. We partner with their area agencies on aging to serve their residents. For training, I would say in Virginia, we do follow that hard and fast federal requirement of 36 hours. But for paid staff ombudsmen, our state policies and procedures state that we get a minimum of 55 hours of training. And that can be delivered in a variety of ways. We do look at the NORC curriculum that Amity was just talking about. That's all online, so we can go through that at our own pace. We also receive group or individual orientation through the state ombudsman office, and we are required to attend an approved mediation or conflict resolution training. And then we spend a lot of time in the field, shadowing current certified long-term care ombudsmen, either in our local area, but we can also go elsewhere in our state and shadow ombudsmen. And that part, I think, is really the most critical, because you're in the building. You're actually seeing everything that you learned about online or everything that you learned about in that orientation. So we spend a lot of time shadowing other folks. And then within our local program, we also, like most programs across the country, have internal processes. If they have an intake line like we do, how to handle calls that come into the intake line. Documentation is key. So everyone probably has a database where they're putting in their information. learning that process. So these are all things that make up that 55 hours. And then once we've completed that, our state ombudsman certifies us.
And Camden, is it possible to contact your program directly? And I'm thinking, since Amity had mentioned already about there are ombudsman programs in every state, talk a little bit more about if somebody wants to get in touch with your program, then Amity, the programs, are they in the state capital or are they in all the counties? But let's start with you, Camden, just as to contacting.
For our program, yes, you can reach us directly. We have a website through Fairfax County that talks about our program. We have an intake line and we have an email where we can get contacted so the community can access through those ways. Also, you can find us on the State Ombudsman website. They have a directory there for the entire state. So if you're looking for someone in the Charlottesville area, you could go through that directory and find that ombudsman and their contact information as well.
Then getting back to you, Amity, if somebody's listening to this program in another part of the country, is there like a National Ombudsman Association where they can find their ombudsman program? Or tell us more about that.
They have to have a state ombudsman program. So each state has an office of the state long-term care ombudsman. But where the office actually is and where the representatives are located varies by state. Some states are what we call centralized, meaning that all the paid representatives are employees of the state ombudsman. They might be part of a state agency. They might be in a nonprofit. And then there's a decentralized program, which is actually the majority of the programs where there's the office of the state ombudsman, and then they contract with what we call local ombudsman entities to provide local ombudsman services. And oftentimes, those local ombudsman entities are housed in area agencies on aging, which your audience may be familiar with. And yes, we do have a directory for the whole country. So at the Resource Center, we are operated by the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care. And the website, you can find a map. You just click on your state and a directory will open up with your Office of the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman information, as well as any local programs, if that's how that state is structured. And that URL is theconsumervoice.org/get_help. But if you just go to the main landing page, you'll see a little map button and you click Get Help and it'll take you right to that map. So I encourage you to reach out to the Ombudsman program. Even if you're not already in a facility or your loved one's not in a facility, but you're looking into long-term care services, again, they provide excellent information and assistance.
I thought I had heard you talk a little bit about volunteers. And so I'm going to start with you, Camden, to give us an overview about the volunteer long-term care ombudsman program. Perhaps you have that in your facility or in your program as well. Tell us a little bit more about that. Explain the background and expertise that volunteers have and how they're trained.
So one of my favorite things to talk about is our program volunteers. So before I became supervisor of our program, I was managing the volunteers for our program for about 5 years. And during that time, I obtained my certification in volunteer administration because I loved that role so much. And I got to see firsthand how this group is so critical to not just our local program, but to the overall ombudsman program in general. They really do allow our program to expand our capacity to advocate for residents. They're there on a more frequent basis than our staff can be. And they're just amazing individuals. So for us, currently, we have 27 volunteers that are visiting 30 facilities in our area. We currently have 146 facilities that we visit in the Northern Virginia area. So we're always looking for more folks to volunteer. We welcome them. We do screen and train and supervise all of our volunteers. We have one dedicated person on our staff who is the volunteer coordinator. That's our role. And a lot of people ask us when they reach out to us, do I have to have a background in advocacy? Do I have to have experience with that? And the answer is yes and no. A lot of people come to us with experience in advocacy. Maybe they used to work in a facility or they come from a social work background or nursing background or some other long-term care experience. But a lot of people come to us without that experience. I have former government workers. I have former IT folks with me, teachers, stay-at-home moms, attorneys. So really all walks of life. We're looking for folks who have an interest in working with older adults, who have a passion for advocacy, who are objective and patient, empathetic for sure, and really good listening and communication skills, because inevitably in this role, you're going to have some tough conversations at some point with a resident, a family member, facility staff. So that piece is really, really important. In terms of training, I'm going to just reiterate some of what Amity mentioned in the previous question about those training requirements that we have at a federal level. That minimum 36 hours of training is what we follow for our volunteers. So even though staff have 55, our volunteers have 36 hours. And we deliver that in three different ways. We do a certain amount of it online, where we push out some online information for them to do on their own. But we do a three-day classroom piece where we bring in folks to talk about infection control and working with people that have dementia. We talk about residents' rights. We talk about what their role is going to be as a volunteer. And we talk about boundaries. That's a really important piece of this role, is setting clear boundaries for us as an ombudsman, but also for the residents. We do also provide them some extensive time out in the field, shadowing other volunteers and other staff. Because again, like I mentioned with the training and staff, they really want to see people in action. They really want to see the communities. They want to talk to the residents. They want to see what's happening in the buildings. And so that part is really important for them. Once they've gone through the training and they've been certified by our state ombudsman as well, that's when we determine together with the volunteer what facility they're going to be in. We do ask that they visit one facility consistently for about 4 hours a week. We ask that they try to give us at least 1 year minimum commitment. And I would say that the average tenure for volunteers in our program is about 5 years, but I have some volunteers that have been with us for more than 10, and I have one volunteer who's been with us for 19. And so I think that's a testament to how committed our volunteers are to the work they're doing with the resident.
And if they wanted to sign up, do they just go to your website and there's a special place?
They can find us on our website. They can also call our intake line and ask to speak to our volunteer coordinator. Her name is Claire Yeomans, and that number is 703-324-5861. Or they can reach out to us via email, which is nvltcop@fairfaxcounty.gov.
Amity, given what Camden was saying in terms of what goes on in her ombudsman program, is there any variation so far as expertise and background? Anything more we need to know about the volunteer long-term care ombudsman program?
Yes, I kept smiling and nodding as Camden was talking. I know you can't see me, but I used to be a local ombudsman, and other than speaking with residents and working with residents, I also loved working with the volunteers. That was my favorite. The ombudsman program, when it was originally conceived, it was really developed as a grassroots program, a community-based program, to where it would work with volunteers, to have neighbors helping neighbors, to really get to know and develop those relationships with residents. So I can't stress how important it is to have volunteers for this program. And as Camden mentioned, volunteers really expand resident access to our services. And if we don't have volunteers due to limited resources that fund this program, it's really impossible to get into those facilities as often as you need to and you want to really support the residents. So I did want to mention that due to the pandemic, and even before the pandemic, there was already a decline in volunteerism, and not just for the ombudsman program. I want to be clear, just nationwide, the traditional volunteer that we used to have in the aging program network that were retired and had a lot of time on their hands. You know, the economy's changed. A lot of people have gone back to work, or they're helping raise their grandkids. There's just a variety of reasons to why we're not having the level of volunteers that we used to. So the ombudsman program was really hit during the pandemic. We lost nearly half of the volunteers across the country. But what I will say is amazing is, even though we're working with less volunteers than we've ever had, we have more hours contributed to the program. So going back to what Camden said about the dedication that these folks have for serving residents is amazing. And I hope, Camden, the volunteers you work with in your program are listening right now. And I want to say thank you to all of them for doing this important work. But visit Camden's website if you live in that area. If you don't and you're listening and you live anywhere else in the country, go to that map I was talking about and locate the program near you and definitely check out how you can volunteer. Because as Camden said, it really is all walks of life come to this volunteer position. Because when you think about it, we have all walks of life in these facilities we're serving.
So I'd like to get on to what happens in terms of the ombudsman programs. Amity, explain to us the types of long-term care facilities that the ombudsman program oversees. You mentioned it a little bit earlier in the interview, but it would be helpful for our listeners to understand what kinds of places we're talking about. What are the most frequent complaints that an ombudsman receives in these types of long-term care facilities, the facilities itself or their services? Give us an overview about that, and then we'll hear from what Camden sees in her program.
As I mentioned earlier, ombudsman programs are federally required by law and regulations to provide services to individuals living in nursing facilities and residential care communities. And residential care communities is an umbrella term for a facility that does not provide skilled nursing care. So these are all licensed by states, and so they're called different things. They could be called in your state assisted living, maybe personal care home, board and care, senior living home. So there's a lot of different names for these communities, but they have to be providing some level of care, just not skilled nursing care. Those are the two primary facility types that ombudsman programs visit. However, some states, just a handful, are also authorized by their state to provide services to individuals receiving long-term care services, which is called home and community-based services, in their own home. So that's few and far between, but a few states do provide that service. As far as complaints, and I definitely want Camden to weigh into what she sees in her area, but we've noticed when looking at the data that there seems to be the same five top complaints year to year to year. They just switch positions in their rankings of the top five. Most significant across both settings, so nursing facilities and residential care, are complaints about care. And then after that, there's complaints about resident rights as a large category, and then admission, transfer, and discharge. So those are the three main categories. But to dig a little deeper into that, in nursing facilities and residential care communities for the last several years, the number one complaint has been about inappropriate discharges or evictions from that setting. Because in both settings, there are rights and requirements related to why the individual is discharged. And if you don't meet those requirements, then it's often an inappropriate discharge. And the ombudsman program can advocate, if the resident wants help, for that resident to stay in that facility or appeal for a discharge hearing to fight that. In nursing facilities, the second complaint last fiscal year was a lack of response or slow response to calls for assistance. You ring your call light and it takes a long time for them to help you. Or they even come in and turn off your light and say, I'll be right back in 5 minutes. And then they don't come back for 30 minutes because they got distracted with something else. The third complaint was physical abuse. And then in residential care communities, again, I said transfer discharge was number one. Medication errors or issues was number two. And then food service was number three. So again, that's all across the country. I assume, Camden, you see something similar in your area.
I do. And I wanted to touch on a couple of things that you mentioned before you started talking about complaints in terms of assisted living and the various terms that they're called. In the state of Virginia, we do refer to them as assisted living facilities. We have about 857 facilities combined, assisted living and nursing across the state, that our ombudsman program across the state serves. In terms of complaints, I would say, obviously, care is always number one, top on our list. Some examples Amity mentioned, we also see response to requests for assistance. Perhaps they haven't had a care plan meeting in several months, even though there's hard and fast requirements in the regulations on how often they should meet. Maybe they're not getting their medications on time, or they have questions about how their medications are being administered. We also get a lot of complaints about therapies, including physical therapy, speech therapy, or occupational therapy.
Food.
No one ever likes the food. That's really controversial. I've never found anyone that's just sort of in the middle about food. People either really like it or they really don't. So we do get a lot of concerns about the food. And sometimes it can be something not just, oh, I don't like what they have to offer. It could be that perhaps they've been prescribed a special diet and the facility isn't following that diet. And so we can advocate to make sure that any and all physician orders are being followed as written. We also get a lot of concerns about discharges, involuntary discharges, as Amity had mentioned. But one of the things that I think we get the most, and this is probably true across the country, is a lot of these other concerns are tied to the concern of poor staffing in facilities. Almost every concern that we get involved in, we can somehow tie to poor staffing if we're not hearing directly from the resident or the family member that whatever they're concerned about is happening due to the fact that they don't feel there's enough staff in the facility. So I just want to point that out because that is something that we hear from almost every single person that does call us. And I imagine that that is probably happening elsewhere.
Amity, I was going to get back to you because I thought I heard you mention, and perhaps you both did, about residents' rights. At the time of the admission of the individual to one of these long-term care facilities, are the families given this information so that they have some sense of what they should expect or what can expect in terms of how the services are provided to their loved one?
The short answer is yes. Facilities are required to share this information at the time of admission. However, family members and residents get a huge stack of information at the time of admission. So it could be one of those things that it's a very overwhelming time and they're just not focused on that. So nursing facilities are also required to post information about resident rights in an area that residents and others can read in the facility. And then, of course, the Ombudsman Program, when they go in, they talk a lot about resident rights and have some information they can leave behind. They have very specific rights. And then in addition to that, the nursing facility has responsibilities to honor and support those rights, such as the right to being treated with dignity and respect, the right to privacy, the right to choice in their daily lives and health, which may seem like an obvious thing, but when you move into a facility and your life is really institutionalized, for lack of a better word, and could be at the whims of, as Camden mentioned, the staffing or lack thereof, you may not feel like you have a lot of control and choice in your life. And so that is your right. And the facility really should be following your choice and your activities when you want to take a shower, if you prefer a shower or maybe a bed bath. You also have the right to complain without the fear of retaliation, the right to be free from any type of abuse or maltreatment, the right to contact outside services such as the Ombudsman Program, the right to participate in healthcare decisions. Camden mentioned care plans. And that's an excellent time for residents, their families, to get together with facility staff to make sure that your choices, your healthcare decisions, everything's being followed and honored and tweaked or changed. And the right to participate in activities both inside and outside the facilities. That's just a few of them. There's more and other ways to apply them, but that's the basics. And nursing facilities are required to inform individuals of those rights. Residential care communities, again, they're licensed by states, so there's different requirements and different rights. Oftentimes, they mirror the rights of the nursing facilities, but not all the time. So you really need to follow your state requirements and talk to your Ombudsman Program.
Camden, I wanted to get back to you. This is such good information that the two of you are sharing. But does the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program educate consumers about long-term care providers and help families choose the best facility for a loved one? Is that part of your job? And if so, how do you disseminate this information? How can listeners learn more about that part of your job?
We do provide that information. And Virginia actually is one of the few states Amity mentioned that has been given the discretion to also provide services, not to just consumers and facilities, but outside in the community as well. Home health, hospice, adult day health care. Those are other types of long-term care services that we can help those consumers if they have issues or concerns. We provide a lot of assistance or information about the provider's available services, what they offer, what the criteria might be in order to be admitted to an assisted living or a nursing facility. Sometimes people are reaching out to us before they've placed their loved one, and they just have a lot of questions about what is that process. So we can give them some information and direct them to the folks that might be able to help get them in if they need long-term care Medicaid or other government types of assistance to get into a facility versus going in privately. We also provide them information regarding inspection reports. Assisted livings in the state of Virginia are licensed by the state. Our nursing homes are also licensed by the state, but have federal oversight in addition. And there are various websites where when the surveyors go into those facilities, they have to post their inspection reports. So we will refer people to those websites so that they can see the most current inspection report and get a sense of what, if anything, was found during that inspection, what's the plan of correction, and has the facility followed through. We also, on our website, have a lot of information about what to look for when you're looking for a facility for somebody, things to look for, questions to ask about maybe staffing, or will my mom or dad have to share a room, or will they have a private room? Just questions surrounding their care, things like that. Through our intake line, we can provide some one-on-one information and assistance. Again, they may be calling with general questions, but sometimes they've narrowed it down to a couple different facilities in our area. And they want to know, in addition to the inspection information, have we been involved with any situations or concerns in that facility? We can obviously not provide them anything that's going to identify a resident in that facility, but we can talk to them about, you know, oh, we've been in to address concerns around medication administration or residents' rights or discharges, sort of high-level aggregate information, just to let them know if any issues have come to our attention in a certain amount of time. Maybe we go back 6-12 months.
Amity, I just wanted our listeners to understand the difference now between the Ombudsman Program and the organization that you represent, the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center. Give us a brief explanation of what the Resource Center is and then how the center partners with the Ombudsman Programs around the country.
I'm the director of the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center, and we are funded by a grant from the federal agency called the Administration for Community Living, or ACL, and they actually fund several resource centers that support all of these Older Americans Act programs. We are charged with training, supporting, creating resources for ombudsman programs across the country to help ensure effective ombudsman program services and consistent services. So we have training for volunteers and staff and how they look at our curriculum, and they do some online and do a lot in the field, which is where the learning really, really happens. We are in the middle of creating an online component for our curriculum, so it'll be even easier for volunteers and staff to utilize that curriculum across the country. So we do those kind of things. We also respond to individual technical assistance requests from programs if they need to know how to code things for the National Ombudsman Reporting System. If they have some questions about program funding, we're really kind of an encyclopedia, and our job is to understand how all these programs work across the country so they can provide peer-to-peer support. We learn a lot from them, and we pass along the best practices.
I'd like to get on to now the facilities, because I think our listeners will really want to hear more from both of you about the difference between licensed and unlicensed long-term care facilities. Give us a little bit of an overview about what the differences are, as well as can unlicensed facilities impact vulnerable residents? How can families learn about these differences of licensure, especially if some of them might have been cited for neglect or substandard care, because I'm sure this is a concern both on a national level as well as in each of the regions. So we'll start with you, Amity, and then go to Camden.
Before I get to that question, I wanted to mention that our resource center is operated by the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care, and they have a ton of free resources for families and consumers about how to find a good facility, how to advocate for quality care. So it's theconsumervoice.org. Some facilities are required to be licensed. So I'm thinking of small group homes, residential care communities, or assisted living, and they operate without a license. So they are operating illegally because they should be licensed by the state. That depends on state requirements again. But there could be some small group homes that don't need a license to operate as a personal care home. That depends on state requirements. So to give you an example, I know of a state that their dividing line is four individuals. So four unrelated individuals living in a group home, you have to have a license for assisted living. But if you have less than four people and they're not related, you don't have to have a license. So the only reason a consumer or family member would know this is if they ask for licensure information whenever they visit that facility. And another really good touchstone is for people that are in hospitals trying to discharge them to a long-term care setting. Ask that discharge planner if they know that that facility is licensed, because that's where we've seen nationally a lot of issues with discharging to a facility that isn't licensed or should be licensed and isn't licensed. That's a really good touchstone to ask that question, because that information should be readily available at the facility and online as well at your state certification entity. Also, folks should know that some nursing homes choose not to participate in Medicaid and Medicare. Those are few and far between, and those would be solely private pay. So those would be licensed by and regulated by the state only and not have that extra layer of federal oversight and regulations. Unlicensed facilities definitely have a negative impact or can have one, especially those that are supposed to be licensed but aren't, and they're operating without one because there's simply not any regulatory oversight. And residents and families may not be aware that they're supposed to have oversight or rights or protections. So you really need to do your homework.
So in Virginia, any assisted living facility that's providing assisted living facility type services, if it's four or more non-related individuals, they should be licensed by the Department of Social Services. And like Amity said, all the nursing facilities are licensed and have federal oversight. In the state of Virginia, they're licensed by the Department of Health Office of Licensure and Certification. We refer to them as OLC. There is no formal way to track unlicensed facilities. What we normally recommend folks to do is either obviously go the extra mile, do their due diligence to check with the different licensing entities within their state. Like I mentioned here in Virginia, that would either be Department of Social Services or OLC for nursing facilities. They can always call us and ask about a certain facility. We keep an internal list of the facilities that we visit, so we would be able to access that information pretty quickly. Is this a facility we know of? If we don't, we can also check with licensing, because new facilities are popping up everywhere. So sometimes we might hear about a new facility opening, but it hasn't quite made it to the licensing website. So we can maybe do a little more digging for the consumers if they have those questions. But obviously, we have concerns about individuals who might choose to live in an unlicensed facility. They may have untrained staff, deplorable living conditions, no real resident right protections or discharge protections. So we would want to educate the consumers about that if they're calling us and are considering that type of facility.
Let's go one step further now. So we have families who have their loved one in a long-term care facility. So let's talk about the complaint process. And Camden, we're going to look to you for that. What should families do if they have a complaint about the treatment of a loved one in a long-term care facility? What would be the process to voice the complaint or resolve the complaint? And then tell our listeners how the ombudsman gets involved, if they do, or maybe other agencies.
Our program wants to empower residents to use their own voice or to have their family members speak up for their loved ones. If they're not able to do that, then obviously reaching out to our program is an option. As Amity had mentioned earlier, we are a resident-directed program. So if we are going to get involved, it's going to be solely at the direction of the resident. Or if they're not able to make decisions on their own behalf, if they have a legal decision maker, that person can give us that permission to advocate for them. Their information is going to be treated confidentially. We're going to make sure that we're trying to advocate and resolve any concerns to the resident's satisfaction. They really do control the extent of our involvement. And we want to make sure that we're representing them and making sure their voices are being heard. We try to work with facility staff to negotiate or try to find a resolution that's going to work for the resident. We understand that these facilities have regulations that they need to work within. We're certainly not going to ask them to do anything that would violate a regulation, but we want to try and resolve these concerns to the resident's satisfaction. We're trying to identify concerns. We're collecting information. Maybe we're talking to staff, talking to other residents. Maybe more than one resident is having the same issue. That sort of speaks to that systemic advocacy that Amity also mentioned earlier in the podcast. I think often we're able to provide creative solutions to problems that can meet both the resident and the provider's interests. However, we're not the only program that could get involved with a resident if they are looking to make a complaint. Additionally, there's Adult Protective Services, APS. All states have an Adult Protective Services program, and they can get involved if residents feel they're being abused, neglected, or exploited. Residents can contact their licensing entities as well. That's public information, and they have every right to reach out to licensing directly. They don't have to go through us. They don't have to go through the facility staff to do that. Sometimes legal services are needed, so they can contact an attorney to help resolve the concern. And we also can co-investigate with those entities. Again, we would need the resident's permission, but often we are asked and invited to work with those other entities to help resolve resident concerns.
It sounds like you get all kinds of situations that you're dealing with. And I was wondering if the long-term care facilities where there haven't been any resident complaints, are they treated differently by the ombudsman program than, say, those that you're always hearing from because there's some kind of a complaint from the family or the loved one themselves? What's the attitude of the ombudsman program towards these facilities and the number of complaints that you hear about them?
The short answer to that question is no, they are not treated any differently. We look at all facilities the same. We're required to visit all of them. The federal program that oversees our program asks that we visit all facilities at least once a quarter. So we try to hit that benchmark as much as possible. Even though you may have a facility where we're not getting a lot of calls, or maybe even our volunteers might be in a facility where they go several weeks without a complaint brought to their attention, it ebbs and flows. No facility is perfect. And you might have a few weeks where everyone's content, and then maybe something like a staff change, maybe a new administrator's come in, and now they want to change things up. And then the next thing you know, we're getting 10, 12 calls. So it really can depend. But no, we do not treat them any differently. We visit them all under the mandate that we're supposed to follow. And we try to advocate for all of those residents as best we can.
I think what Camden mentioned about ebbing and flowing is important, and that there's no perfect facility. The real marker is there are going to be complaints because, again, we're all individuals and we want different things certain ways. The real indicator is if the facility works with the resident and families and ombudsman program, when applicable, to resolve that complaint. That's where you get the quality care. That's where you get that responsiveness because complaints are going to happen.
I thought I heard you say, Camden, that it's once a quarter. Does just the staff of the ombudsman program go? Do the volunteers go? And the most important question I bet you our listeners are wondering is, are the facilities notified in advance of that visit and welcome the ombudsman program, or are they very surprised when someone walks in?
The goal at the federal level and really just for program management and access for residents is to provide what we call routine access, which is a quarterly visit to each facility. But reality happens. A lot of programs don't have the resources to provide those quarterly visits. To give you some perspective, for example, there's over 15,000 nursing facilities, and nearly all of them received at least one visit last year in the federal fiscal year, which is really impressive. But just over 9,000 received a quarterly visit. So you can see the big difference between one visit a year versus quarterly. And similarly, there are 62,000 residential care communities. So that's where we've seen the increase in facilities. The number of nursing facilities nationally continues to decline, and the number of residential care communities continues to increase with time. So a little more than half received at least one visit, but only 14,000 received quarterly visits to residential care communities. So that was an increase since last year, which is great. But as I mentioned, every facility, most facilities don't receive quarterly visits, but ombudsman programs really do the best they can with the limited resources, and they just really need more support, including volunteers, to increase that access.
Camden, talk a little bit more about the volunteer versus the staff, and are these long-term care facilities happy to see you?
In the state of Virginia, we have 19 local offices staffed by 32 staff ombudsmen, but many of them are part-time. So that quarterly visit mandate can be difficult for some programs. We're lucky here in Northern Virginia. We have 7 full-time staff and 1 part-time staff. Paid staff go in quarterly. Our volunteers, we do ask that they go in a minimum of 4 hours every week to their facility. So they are definitely in there more frequently. And they are able to establish some relationships with their residents and even with the staff by being there so frequently. That quarterly mandate is for what we call routine access visits, but we also make visits to facilities for a lot of other reasons. So it's not like a paid staff person is going in there just once a quarter and then never going back to that facility until the next quarter. Often we have to go in if we're working with individual residents for a case, we're going to be going in to address those concerns. We also go in to attend resident and family councils if we're invited. We also go in to provide training and outreach. We are making more than just quarterly visits throughout the year. We do ask that our staff and our volunteers try to go as unannounced as possible. So we typically do not let them know when we are coming. Now, I will say we do have some volunteers that with that 4-hour schedule, they might break it up. And maybe if it works for their facility, they might have one day, like every Tuesday, they go from 10 to noon. So their residents know to expect their ombudsman from 10 to noon, which can be helpful if a concern's coming up. They're like, oh, I know Camden's coming on Tuesday from 10 to noon. I'm going to make a point to go down and talk to her. And maybe the rest of their visits for the week, they just sort of scatter and show up unannounced. We really sort of leave it up to the volunteer to figure that piece out, what works best with their schedule. As far as whether or not they welcome us, I would say most of them do. Some don't. That's the reality. I like to think that they do welcome us because really, I think most of them do want to provide quality care to their residents, and they just see us as another set of eyes and ears to help make positive changes for the residents.
When you and your volunteers or your fellow staff members walk in the door, what's that process? What does that look like when ombudsmen visit long-term care facilities? Regardless of what the purpose is, but especially if there might be some concerns or something.
When we're making our routine access visits, we're trying to make ourselves available to as many residents and family members as possible during the visit. So depending on the size of the facility, we could be there for an hour and a half, or we could be there 4 to 5 hours. It really just depends. The concerns ebb and flow. If we're getting a lot of concerns during our visit, we're probably going to be there a little bit longer than if we're not. In addition to talking to residents and families, we also try to talk with staff while we're there because the staff are excellent resources for our program. They are there every day working with the residents. They can give us a lot of information and let us know what's going on in the facility when we're not there. I think this is especially true for our volunteers because they're there so frequently. They also develop those working relationships with staff to the point where maybe when the volunteer shows up, they might say, hey, something happened over the weekend. Here's what happened. You're probably going to hear about it from the residents. Here's what we're doing to work on that concern. So talking to the staff is really important. We encounter residents in their rooms and common areas. We're always looking around, trying to see, does it look clean? Are the residents clean? We're asking them questions about their care, their services, getting to know them a little bit. we're using all five senses when we're in the building. Do we smell anything funny? Do we see anything funny? We're also looking at things that, like activity calendars and food menus. Are they actually doing the activities and serving the food that's posted for that day or for that month? Any concerns that are brought to our attention during our visits, as long as we have permission, we will take it to someone on staff to try and resolve. Some of them in our program, and I hope others do as well, we really make a habit of trying to point out as many positives as possible to the staff during our visits, because I know they're hearing all about the bad stuff a lot. So we really want to make sure that they're also hearing about the good stuff too.
I'd like to throw out this question. We'll start with you, Amity, about the bigger picture of the ombudsman program. The quality of life is so important for persons receiving long-term care services. So more on a national basis, how does the ombudsman program advocate for improving quality of life?
As far as advocating for improving quality of life, I wanted to bring back what Camden just mentioned about working with the staff and talking about the positives about what we see. You really have to, because ombudsman programs, again, don't have the power of enforcement. We're not part of regulatory. We just have the power of persuasion, of understanding requirements, understanding rights, empowering residents, and really raising their voice to urge people to do the right thing for residents. So you have to have a good working relationship with the providers in order to make an impact on the resident's life. So as far as the big picture and advocating for improving quality of life, I think it really goes back to the roots of the program being so broad, and that you provide this individual advocacy case by case with the resident, but you also, as an ombudsman, work with the resident council and address concerns that are facility-wide. Then you could sometimes work with a chain of facilities and have to, as ombudsmen, we task them with submitting reports on a regular basis. So they may analyze their data and realize, wow, this one chain of facilities that's owned by XYZ Corporation is really discharging a ton of people for non-payment. How can we address this issue at a system level? So then you work with the corporate office to see what's going on. And then again, you could work at the state or even federal level for some legislation that is pending that may improve the quality of life and care, or may be detrimental to the quality of life and care, and you may be fighting against that. So there's just such a swath of responsibilities that this program has. And all of those together is the big picture way for gradually improving quality of life and care, and really just grounding the care that people receive in long-term care in the resident's perspective, and reminding everybody involved, including family members sometimes, that this is an individual that has a whole history of lived experience behind them, and they have every right to live the fullest life possible in this new setting. That's what I think the big picture is for moving it forward.
Camden, bringing it down to your level then, how and where do ombudsmen educate community residents about long-term care concerns and the ombudsman program? Do you go out on a speaking tour? Are there certain organizations that you make presentations for? If listeners are interested in learning more from wherever the ombudsman program is in their geographic area, would they call the ombudsman program also about getting a presentation, or how do you handle that?
We never say no to an outreach request, or we try really hard not to say no. We do a lot of outreach or a lot of education about our program. It could be about topics such as residents' rights or abuse, neglect, exploitation. We try to cover any and all topics that come our way or in regards to the requests that we receive. We do outreach in facilities where maybe we're talking to the resident council or family council. We get called in to provide presentations or training for facility staff. We do a lot of community events, maybe tabled events or fairs, like safety and wellness fairs. Community colleges, for example, we're on the schedule to do the class for a lifelong learning institute in our area for the next winter term, sometime in January and February, where we're going to basically do an overview of our program to their students. We've also spoken to CNA, classes, CNA students, to teach them about our program and educate them about what we do. We also can provide a consultation to providers. They can call our intake line and talk to us about our program or if they have situations going on in their facility. And if they want to make sure they're not violating residents' rights, things like that, we're happy to provide those consultations to them as well.
How can consumers learn more about Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program? And both of you, any final comments that you want to state as well as resources?
If you want to learn more about the Ombudsman Program, I encourage you to visit theconsumervoice.org. There at the top of that website, there's a button that says Get Help. And that's where you can go to our map and find your local or statewide program. And then our National Ombudsman Resource Center website, most of our resources are geared for ombudsmen, not necessarily consumer facing. But if you really want to learn about the program, you can visit that website. And it's ltcombudsman.org. But I encourage you to visit either one of those websites. There's even some really quick videos on the landing page about ombudsmen, where you can, in 3 to 5 minutes, learn the basics about the ombudsman program and how to direct people to get help. I encourage you to visit those. And if you are a consumer or family member interested in long-term care services, check out theconsumervoice.org for all of those free resources on how to ensure that your loved one gets quality care.
If you're listening and you're in our area, whether that be Fairfax County, Arlington County, City of Alexandria, or Loudoun County, our website is full of information, including our intake line, which is 703-324-5861. If you go to the fairfaxcounty.gov website and you look for Department of Family Services and click on older adults, our program information will be in there along with lots of other different services under our Adult and Aging Division. We also have email where people can reach out to us. That's nvltcop@fairfaxcounty.gov. For folks that may be in other parts of the state of Virginia and you're curious about who your ombudsman might be, I would refer you to our state ombudsman website, which is www.elderrights.virginia.gov. There is an ombudsman directory on that site. It sounds very similar to the one you can find nationally. It's a map of Virginia. You just click on your county and it'll bring up the contact information for that ombudsman. If you happen to be listening outside of the Virginia area, check out National Consumer Voice to find the ombudsman for your state.
Well, I want to thank Camden Doran, supervisor of the Northern Virginia Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, and Amity Overall Labe, director of the National Ombudsman Resource Center, for joining me today. Thank you both for giving us so much helpful information about the Ombudsman Program. To learn more about Aging Matters, you can visit our website, which is agingmattersonline.com. And of course, at that site, you can access all of the Aging Matters radio programs, the TV show episodes, and of course, you can log on to the podcasts, which Aging Matters now produces on Apple, Spotify. So again, agingmattersonline.com. Aging Matters is produced in association with Steve Lack Audio. To learn more about that company, just visit stevelackaudio.com, stevelackaudio.com. Thank you for listening to Aging Matters today. And remember, age is just a number, not a label. I'll be back again with you next week.
Seabury Resources for Aging is a proud partner of Aging Matters. As a nonprofit, Seabury serves older adults in the Washington, D.C. region and across the United States with its care management model to support caregivers and their loved ones. Seabury is a pioneer in the field of services for older adults, providing affordable housing and support services to help older adults age in place. For more information, visit their website, seaburyresources.org, or call them at 202-289-5690.